House Committee on Revenue for June 15, 2009 will come to order. Colleagues, today we have one item on our agenda, Senate Bill 767, and we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 767. Steve, do you want to explain the bill to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 767B is fairly involved. I'll just do a very cursory summary of it. It starts out defining a virtual public charter school as a school that provides online courses and excludes those that would primarily serve students at a physical location. It requires that virtual schools have various kinds of plans, including an agreement to employ only highly qualified licensed teachers. It requires virtual schools to have itemized budgets from any third-party entities that they contract with for services. It would prohibit a for-profit entity from employing the virtual school employees. Specifies the applicability of the 50% residency requirement for all public charter schools. It requires virtual and other public charter school applicants to provide various plans for financial management. It establishes the online learning task force, specifying membership items to include in the work plan, and directs the task force to do a report and prepare legislation. And then it imposes a moratorium on three things. One, the approval of charters for virtual schools that would be established after the effective date of the act. The limits the number of students in a virtual school to be the same as May 1, 2009, with exceptions. And then it would also put a moratorium on state board waivers of any provisions of the virtual school statutes. It repeals the moratorium on July 1, 2011, and it declares an emergency and would take effect upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Dembrow, I see, is here. Would you like to be heard on this bill this morning?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have quite a list this morning, and generally speaking, I'm going to ask people to limit their remarks. But you may be trying to explain portions of the bill, and so we'll give you a couple minutes more, but try to keep it brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barnhart, members of the Revenue Committee, pleasure to be here this morning. I'm Representative Michael Dembrow from House District 45, Northeast Portland, Two Park Rows. And I'm actually pinch-hitting today. The chief sponsor could not be here. Representative Buckley is downstate for a well-deserved vacation. That is what we call a weekend. He's on his way back up. It's a pleasure for me, though, to be able to speak to this bill. I am a co-sponsor of it, and I also have a great deal of experience with the issues that it covers. For the actual details of the bill, I believe that Lori Wimmer is going to speak to that, Ms. Chair, so if you could call her up next, that would be great.
Thank you.
I come to this as a strong believer in online education. I have a lot of experience, direct experience with it myself as a college teacher of writing and literature. I've taught online myself. I've evaluated online courses. I've been in the departmental wars over online education. You may not be surprised to know that support of online education is not universal among faculty. And so we've had a lot of battles in the departments. I think we have gradually moved the conversation to the point that my college, Portland Community College, is now one of the preeminent providers of online higher education in the state, and I think does a very good job of it. What I've come to learn in my experience with online education is, really two fundamental things. First, online education can be very good, and online education can be very bad. And generally, the difference has to do with the relationship between teacher and student and the degree to which an online community, learning community, is created. Those programs where there is a great deal of engagement and interaction will be more successful in terms of learning. The other thing that I've learned is that online education doesn't work for a lot of people. I'm one of them. I took an online course once, and it was a disaster. And, you know, I'd like to think it's not because I'm not a good student, but that modality just did not work for me. But for some, it works very well. And I will say that for some, it really is essential, depending on, you know, where they live. We have a lot of students who live in remote, well, not remote, but more rural parts of our district, and it's hard for them to get to a campus, or because of their life circumstances or perhaps disabilities that they have. Doing it at home online is really important to them. And, in fact, it's vital. So that's kind of my background with online education in general. But more specifically to the issues in this bill, I served the last couple of years on the State Board of Education as the community college faculty advisor. And during that time, we really had to grapple with this issue of online education in K-12. From my perspective, it's kind of the Wild West out there, where, and a lot of it has to do with, I mean, some of it has to do with issues of quality, but I think, you know, the big problem that I saw in my time had to do with issues of governance. You know, as you probably know or will hear, in 2005, the legislature passed legislation in House Bill 1071 that limited a district's ability to offer online education so that 50% of those students in their program had to live in the district. And that was legislation that was presented and argued and adopted in order to deal with a problem that had already begun to surface of small districts seeking to offer online programs that would be statewide. There already existed a program in SIO, the ORCA program, which still exists. And there you had a situation in which I think about 15 of the students in ORCA actually are resident of SIO, and nearly 2,500 students are from elsewhere in the district. There were other schools came forward to seek waivers from the state board in order to be able to do the same. And it caused the state board to engage in a lot of discussion. A lot of time was spent on it, and I think continues to. And knowing that whatever the state board did, the legislature was looking over its shoulder and would probably at some point come in and engage. In fact, I remember someone on the state board who's actually very closely related to one of the members of the committee making that very comment, you know, that whatever we do, the legislature is going to come in and do what it's going to do. So essentially, that's what this bill is. It's the legislature coming in and saying we need to do a comprehensive look at online education in this state. It should come in the form of a task force on online learning, which will engage with this issue and make recommendations to the 2010 special session of the legislature, assuming that there will be one, and that it will allow us to really look at this this governance question on a statewide basis, because there are some really significant problems, I think, of students who live in one part of the state, but the board that oversees their education is in another part of the state, and which the, you know, parents have no direct interaction with. how we deal with this issue is, you know, I think very open. Some people have suggested a statewide program for which different organizations like Connections Academy, Insight Schools, others can bid for to be able to offer their program statewide. Others have looked at doing it district by district. Those are conversations that we need to have, and the task force will be able to have. As far as what's in the bill itself, as I said, Lori can go through that for you. But what I did want to share with you is a request from the chief sponsor that this bill go to the floor as you have it before you, that is, without amendments. There are some ideas out there for amendments, and, you know, I will say, frankly, that some of them have some merit. However, there is real concern that at this point in the session, amending this bill and sending it back to the Senate would really be a problem. So I would urge you to send it as it is. However, this too is something that I believe the sponsor would agree that I can share with you, and that's that there are some concerns about who is on the task force, and there are several parties who are not, you know, currently listed, who I think we would really want to have at the table. And that would include parents of online students, the State Board of Education, perhaps someone from an online school now. It would be really essential that such people be at the table. We do not need to amend this bill to bring them to the table. And I think that that's something that can be made clear when this bill is presented on the floor. The other thing is, I know there's a lot of concern among parents of online students that passing this bill will shut down their ability to have online education. And, you know, I really believe that one of the ground rules for the task force can be that what comes out of this will not intrude upon the ability of current online students to continue to receive online education. I've had a lot of conversations with online parents since this issue surfaced, and I'm really impressed with their they're good people, and they're really committed to their kids' education, and it's really admirable. I'm very pleased to see them engaging with the public education system. We want to keep them engaged, to keep them part of the public education system. And I think that what will come out of this task force will allow that to happen. So I'm going to close now, Mr. Chair. I do want to make one point, though. It came to me as I was talking. I don't want anybody to think that I don't have the highest regard for the town of Scio. I've come over the course of this session to really appreciate it, I look forward to seeing the chicken at some point. It's the chicken. Oh, the rooster. I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you, colleagues, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Lori Wimmer.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of your committee, Lori Wimmer with the Oregon Education Association, representing 48,000 members in K-12 and community colleges. I'm also a member of the Oregon Virtual School Advisory Council, which was created as a spinoff organization to advise the Oregon Virtual School District after the 2005 law was passed, 1071, which pretty much set us on this road today. I've given you a number of documents because you have not had the benefit of the 23 amendments and 22 weeks worth of discussion on this topic that the Senate has. So I thought a little background would be useful to you as you contemplate this over the next 24 hours. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that here except to review with you the course this bill has taken in those 22 weeks. Initially, the education community and the seven legislators who brought the bill forward had a much more aggressive idea about how to cope with some of the problems that we'd all seen and identified with respect to the unregulated environment that came through basically as an opportunity of accident. That would have clarified that the 2005 law, Senate Bill 1071, meant it when it said 50% of the students needed to come from within the sponsoring school district of a virtual charter school. That was deliberately devised to discourage a entrepreneurial bent for the creation of these programs, which would have a perverse incentive to take a look at the educational quality, access issues, equity, and so on that we've identified over these past 22 weeks and prior to that before the Board of Education with respect to some of the programs that exist out there. What happened in those 23 sets of amendments is that a lot of good ideas came to the table, and we listened. And through that amendment process, we basically jettisoned some of the more straightforward policy positions, with the exception of those that seem to be consensus-based. For example, there is a whole section in the bill related to quality standards for online learning that was developed last session in a work group that included all parties, and everyone agreed and signed off on those. They then became part of a bill sponsored by Representative Arne Roblin, and so we added those to our bill as well. There were also financial management accountability provisions in another bill on the Senate side by Senator Vicky Walker that seemed reasonable, that had to do with just making sure that sound, stable financial mechanisms were in place for the management of all charter schools, and that also made its way into an amended version of Senate Bill 767. So those are some of the kinds of things that we did, as well as eliminating pieces that we thought originally ought to be in the bill. Through that long journey, we finally got a bill that was able to come from the Senate to you all, and we would be very grateful for your agreement to send it to the floor, do pass. The Oregon Education Association believes that online learning is, as Representative Dembro said, a tool that can prepare students or enable students to have access to fine quality educational content in conjunction with their studies in brick and mortar schools or in lieu of, in certain rare circumstances. For example, you often will hear about students who are too ill to attend school, who have work commitments, or in the case of my own stepdaughter, she was an actor and simply couldn't be in school all the time because of her shooting schedule for a television show. There are circumstances like that. A lot of superintendents have told us, for example, that students who flunk a class can sometimes make up that class so they can graduate with their classmates if they can take an online class to make up that credit. They call that credit recovery. So there are times and places, and also for students who are trying to access a course that their school doesn't offer, either because they're too remote or because it's something that is just not part of the regular curriculum, Latin, Chinese, what have you. Those are all appropriate uses of online learning for some students, obviously not for all. In the case of K-12 learning on a laptop only, we had originally had some concerns about elementary students, especially, who can't be home alone, who must have a learning coach. That's a barrier that economics and sometimes language, the home-based language, can prohibit students from participating. And when you've got public dollars at stake, that was a concern as far as access and equity. There are a number of issues. This is a very complex topic. But you will notice that in my testimony, I point out that there are a variety of different modes of delivery of this technology tool, which will never replace relational learning in a face-to-face interaction, but can supplement it. And that is, there are higher ed institutions that offer high school students courses. There are the private for-profit. There are school districts, such as SK Online, who offer their own programs to students. There are ESDs that offer these programs. There are a number of different ways. There, a lot of homeschoolers choose to pay tuition themselves. In fact, the vast majority of homeschoolers do not have state-subsidized homeschooling. They use their own resources for whatever their curriculum is, whether books or online curriculum. But so there are so many different options out there. It makes sense for the state to wrap its arms around this whole issue and find a better way to do this so that we can control for quality, accountability, transparency, access, and equity issues, and make sure that students are getting what they need, and also that we don't in any way advantage the few at the expense of the many. And by that I mean we have a circumstance in which students who are preferring the bricks and mortar traditional public education are finding their dollars rerouted to some of these programs because the dollars come from the district where the student lives and goes to the sponsoring charter. And that can be financially disruptive for districts. Right now, two of the for-profits, for example, that exist at current enrollment levels, the conservative estimate is $39 million per biennium, leaves the other districts in order to finance these homeschool online students. So with that, I think I'd be happy to close and answer any questions you might have. I think your legislative revenue staff already went over the elements that are in the 23rd version of this bill. I'd be certainly happy to go over them if you need me to, but I've also included that with my testimony, so you can also read it for yourself. I also have included a copy of a letter written by one of the chief sponsors, Representative Peter Buckley, who couldn't be here today, but who gave me permission to give you a copy of a letter he gave to the Senate when this was over there. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your presentation, and I appreciate the information about being able to add to the committee. I know that's one of the concerns that I've heard. The other concern that I've persistently heard, and I would feel better if I could have some confirmation about it, is what happens during this period of moratorium to students who are currently enrolled in an online charter. And I think that the place that specifically has been raised is for the ORCA charter out of SIO. Can you tell me what work you've done, what information you have that would tell us what changes, if any, would a student who is currently enrolled today at ORCA see on September 1st if this bill passes and becomes law?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Gelser, our understanding is that there would be no changes that they would recognize because the Department of Education sought an Attorney General's opinion when the ORCA attorneys were working with the State Board and were asserting a right in perpetuity to operate without any laws passed subsequently ever to impact their ability to continue outside the law that was passed in 2005. And in that Attorney General opinion, it said that for the life of the contract that preceded the law, Senate Bill 1071, which was a five-year period that ends on June 30th, 2010, next summer, that the school is indeed not subject to any laws that pass subsequently. I would assume that means this law as well. After that point, however, upon renewal, a school district, a charter school would then be subject to any subsequent law, but not until that point. So as of September 1st of this year, nothing. And presuming that the 2010 supplemental legislative session should enact legislation that comes out of the task force recommendations, it would be my assumption that that could extend to never have to experience any kind of change.
Great follow-up.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So just to clarify really simply, it's your understanding, because what I have heard is a concern that a lot of students could be displaced in September. But what I am hearing is that it is not the intent of the sponsors of the bill and supporters of the bill, nor is it the expectation based on information that you've received from the Attorney General that any student would be displaced in September of 2009, and that by requiring this group to come back, in February, it will be the legislature's responsibility to respond in February to determine what happens with these students moving forward after this coming school year.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelsa, that's exactly what I was saying.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a written opinion from the AG?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do, and I'll be happy to provide it to the committee.
That would be wonderful for the committee to have that. I know that was one of the questions that had come up before us. I'm going to stick on this topic. My understanding is that the law that was in place at the time this contract was signed allowed for a five-year contract.
Mr. Chair, the law actually was enacted 4 months after the charter was signed. Therefore, the charter preceded the law, and that's why for these 5 years they are not subject to
it. And the charter was for 5 years?
Yes.
Okay. So the next time the legislature can affect the nature of that contract is at the expiration of the contract.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelsa.
Could we possibly, just given the importance of that question, could we invite Legislative Council down to answer that question as well about
yes.
the September 09 enrollment?
The room's pretty full. Is Legislative Council here? No.
I think it's Hannah Lai who's the drafter.
I think it would be reasonable to ask for that, but I think if we could have the AG opinion, that would be helpful. That what you've described as the AG opinion is my understanding of what the law is about the law of contracts. The legislature can't unilaterally change a contract in the middle of it by passing a law.
Right.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. That was, you know, very much the understanding of the State Board during these discussions. In fact, we heard from some of the competitor companies who were complaining that Connections Academy was able to have such a contract, and they were not. And in some cases, they were urging us to void that contract so that there would be a level playing field. But, of course, that was not possible. We had clear guidance about that from the Department of Ed lawyers.
She's here.
Oh, good. Please, while we're on this topic, let's discuss it now. Representative Gelser, you have some questions.
Yes, I think we were just seeking some confirmation. We're wanting to make sure that if this bill passes as written, that students currently enrolled in an online charter would continue to be able to be enrolled on September 1st. And it sounds like there's an AG opinion, which we're hoping will be coming in writing very soon, that says that's the case, and wanted to see from Legislative Council's opinion. Are you confident that any student enrolled today at an online charter would be able to continue their enrollment in an online charter on September 1st if this bill passes as written today?
Chair Representative Gelser, I have not seen the opinion
For the record.
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Hannah Lai, Legislative Council. Chair Representative Gelser, I have not seen the opinion from the Attorney General. I would be very interested in seeing it. I'm not as confident as what other people are presenting here. I would like to look at some of what this opinion says. So,
well, let's give you the chance to do that.
Yes, I'd very much appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So given that, I think that was what you wanted her for, wasn't it?
So it sounds like maybe you'll read the opinion and then we can have her back after she's read the opinion.
I think that would be helpful.
Yes.
Is that okay with you?
Definitely, yes.
Thank you very much. We'll let you go now.
And everything comes up.
This is the week when everything happens.
Okay.
That hasn't happened all session. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay.
We're going to change topics now, I believe, and so we'll excuse you to read the opinion and then come back when you're ready.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with your indulgence, I have probably more than just a couple
sure,
questions
that's
here.
Fine.
And I'll keep them brief. And I thank both of you for your investment of time into this issue. And quite frankly, I have a couple questions that might be kind of hardball questions, but this is a tough issue that deserves a comprehensive and thorough conversation because we're talking about 2,500 kids learning in a system that they love. And so a couple things that came up, and one of them that I was just going to touch on was that piece there that Hannah spoke to. And just to clarify, that Attorney General's opinion is in reference to existing law. That it's not in reference to Senate Bill 767. I understand there's some common themes, but that's not an opinion on this pending legislation. Is that correct?
Representative Springer, Chair Barnhart, that is correct, but it's based on an assumption that of the contract laws the Chair had mentioned, that subsequent laws that pass during the life of a contract can't be imposed until the contract expires.
Okay. And I guess you just highlighted the concern I have is that we're making some decisions on assumptions here. And that concerns me, and so I do want to get that ironed out with Hannah Lai. You made the comment, Lori, you were talking about, and certainly this is a concern I would share, those parents that maybe just aren't able to be at home with their kids and monitor that system, at least in a traditional 7 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon kind of situation. Do we have examples of that? Where that has, number one, that has occurred, and number two, that has compromised the quality of education?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Springer, what we know is that in the case of the requirement of a learning coach, though in an agreement between ORCA and the Attorney General for the Department of Ed, they backed down from the requirement that a parent be that learning coach. It is our understanding that it is the parent that is the person. They must speak English. That's also a requirement. And it is also our understanding that they have to be available during typical normal banking hours, not the asynchronous times a day that we always hear touted as an advantage of online learning. So that's our understanding, and that means that there are going to be families who self-select out of that option as a result.
Follow up, I'm sorry, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, please,
before
go ahead.
Follow up.
No, that's fine.
Do we have examples?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Springer,
that's a real concern, but do we have an example, or is it just a concern that we're thinking could be there?
It is my understanding that it's a concern that we have and that there are evaluations of that program that also raised that concern and that gave them failing marks on that access issue category in those evaluations for that very reason. I don't have a person's name, but that's because those are people who don't step forward. So it's a little hard to bring you people.
And Mr. Chair, if I can just add, and this was a concern of the state boards, and I think continues to be, the question of equity of access. And I do think, if I can add, I think that this would very much be part of the agenda of the task force to look into that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you both. Another one?
Please.
I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Representative Denbrough, you talked about, and both of you have talked about the makeup of the board, the task force that we're talking about here, and I've looked at that quite a bit. And obviously I share the concerns, that one of the concerns you've brought out, but another concern that I have, and I'll just put this on the record, and it strikes me as interesting, and I don't know that it would be an incentive for people to participate, but it actually calls for 6 legislators to be on this task force. I don't know a lot of people that want to serve on a committee with 6 legislators. That's a bit of a concern, and I say that in some humor, but in addition to that, I really am concerned about the makeup of this board. There's no representation of virtual or online learning, and the only charter school representation is a member who represents public charter schools. And then we have several others, great folks to have on a board when you're talking about education, but not appearing to be very balanced. And a comment was made that they can always come to the table later, we don't need to amend it. I'm concerned about that language, and that board makeup there is a real sticking point. So I don't know. I guess I want to hear some further thoughts from you. And I know that this bill came, we have the sponsors, but it came at the request of COSA, American Federation of Teachers, and I don't see them in the room, but also Oregon School Employees Association, Oregon Education Association. And so if you could help me understand why those names came to the surface and charter and online did not come to the surface.
Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, I share your concerns, and I would go farther. In the Dash 22s, which we requested, they were in. The Dash 23s, they came out at the decision of other parties to the bill. But just as we had in the last interim in the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, a technical work group that advised ex officio the actual appointed task force and how to see that it had a voice without legislation. It was just realizing that there were lapses in the appointments that could be filled through this ex officio technical group. We thought that was a good model to replicate because the three of the four of the requesters you just named, Representative Springer, there's only one seat for organizations representing employees too. So in addition to not having virtual providers or parents on this task force, there are also, I think, a failure to include all the folks who brought the bill to the legislature in the first place. And so we see that ex officio process as a place for all of that to be remedied, as well as for a member of the Board of Education, because they also have spent enormous amount of time and effort and research on this issue. And it seems to me that that would also be remedied if we could have that. And I certainly would pledge to push to make that happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please, go ahead.
Actually, I wasn't clear in my look. That was me. I again. switching gears a little bit, on page 6, there is language, lines 22 through 26. Talks about the sponsor of a virtual public charter school or member of the public may request access to any of the documents described in section 1 and 2 of this section. So that section is talking about an online contracting with a for-profit business to provide their curriculum, and then anybody has access through the online school to the information from the business that's providing that, if I'm understanding this correctly. I when it comes to education, I'm not concerned about a company making a profit or not making a profit. I'm concerned with providing for kids what they need to learn based on who they are. So I'm not about protecting businesses and by any means here in this scenario. But as I look at that, I'm thinking of the online curriculum provider that is a business having their books, their private business, having their books opened up as a public entity. And I don't know that we go to our textbook companies or our desk providing companies or the windows in the schools. I don't know that we go to those companies and ask for that information. So help me understand that. Is there something I'm missing in this? Because quite frankly, I can see business the same. I'm not doing business with you because of that. So I think this feels like it's in there to create a problem.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Springer, that was not our hope. The transparency piece had to do with the work of the task force, first of all. We had a companion bill to 767 at the beginning of the session, Senate Bill 811, that would have proposed a different and lesser ADM distribution to a laptop student as a brick-and-mortar student because you aren't feeding, you aren't providing PE or band or orchestra or theater, you aren't fielding a football team, you aren't transporting, you aren't housing. There are a lot of cost differentials with respect to the two students, so we felt that based on the studies we had seen out of Kansas and elsewhere, that around 40% would be the actual cost of providing an online full-day education. And we withdrew that bill in favor of just going with the task force instead so that we could find out precisely what the differences are. I can tell you that in the state board review of all of this, I had repeatedly asked how much of the state school fund dollar of that $6,040 that goes per student to the online charter school, how much of that goes to profit? I mean, is there a cost savings if the public school provides that or a statewide or a regional consortium provides it instead? Do you lose money bleeding out through the profit that you could retain if it were based on a public system as we traditionally provide education? I'm talking about the entire thing, not items that aren't provided by the public already, but teaching is it's labor of employees. It's not just a book. And so if you're providing an entire education management industry, how much of that state school fund dollar, how much of that public resource goes to private gain, just as school districts have to be transparent about every dollar they spend and anyone can know any dime spent. We thought that it would be fair if you're going to take public resources that you also disclose, not open your books in general, but show, as it says in the bill, how much you're paying your Oregon-based executives and consultants. And that was so that we can, as far as the task force goes, determine what the right amount of money should be for providing that education.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow. You know, I think also I would question the analogy with textbooks and suppliers. You know, here we're talking about entities that are providing instruction to our children, and it would be as if we were asking textbook providers to actually not only have the textbooks but do the teaching. And I think there's a dramatically different level of expectation there, and there should be.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I agree that there are some differences there, and I do appreciate and value both of you indulging my questions because I know they're not real fun questions, but I think they're important for folks sitting in this audience, for sure. But it is my understanding with the providers of the curriculum, we still have a teacher that works for the school, right? So we haven't eliminated the teacher. We still have an online teacher that the student answers to. So I'm thinking we still have some similarities there that we're looking at, and I'll just offer that up. I think, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, both of you.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. Two questions, if you will. One related to the 2005 legislation. Do either of you know, and you may not have the answer to this, have any statewide virtual schools been created since that 2005?
The virtual district.
Yeah. Which one?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, well, the bill itself created the Oregon Virtual School District, which was modestly funded. The idea was that eventually it could grow into being a statewide provider. At this point, it provides a curriculum. The Department of Education was able to negotiate both donations of and very low cost provision of some very fine curriculum. And I know, for example, one of the chief sponsors, School District Ashland, uses it in conjunction with their own teachers.
The question was, have any statewide, other than the one, that one, have any?
Yes, there have been. The State Board issued a waiver to allow K-12 Inc. to provide statewide through the North Bend School District.
And so it is up and going?
One. It is up and going.
Okay. That's. I just wanted to find out just how many.
And there's a second one, too, excuse me, the West Lane Charter School. It's the other one.
Okay. Here's my real question, and it relates to you, Representative Denbrough. You were on the State Board of Ed, and as you indicated, I have a conflict or personal interest here because you serve with my husband, who is still on the State Board of Ed and who has spent tons, the board, the staff, they have done extensive work on this issue. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Then why are we proposing a legislative solution and a legislatively appointed board when we have a policy group steeped in information who is willing to work on this and, as you so cynically put, feels often preempted when the legislature comes to town and decides for a more political solution when they are a policy board who would be more than willing to get this issue advanced if only the legislature would have the confidence and not come in the back door and undo whatever they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you know, I think that, as I indicated, there still remains, you know, many uncertainties on the part of the State Board about their authority, as you know, I think they should. And in their last report, one of the things that they urged was some legislative clarification of this issue. And I believe that that's exactly what this is all about. You know, last night I devoted my evening last night listening to the audio archives of the various 2005 committee meetings devoted to this topic. My heart goes out to my colleagues, you know, from that time, because those hearings were in June, July, and August. So we should be grateful for, I think, what we have. I believe that the discussion was very clear about the intent of the 50% restriction, and yet despite that, some entities have been pursuing a loophole in that very clear interest. And so I think it's just essential for the legislature to clarify this issue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I won't pursue this question further. I think I've made my feeling pretty clear that this is a preempt of their authority. But if we're going to do this, I think that we should have broader representation on the legislative task force. And to that end, I would like to have passed out to the committee a amendment, that B-26 amendment. I know you are not entertaining amendments, but I would like to have the committee have it basically calls for a broader representation on that board to include the State Board of Education, parents, and other professionals connected to it goes from 13-member task force to a 17-member task force. So I would like to have this before the committee, if you wouldn't mind, sir.
Thank you. Of course, we're not in work session, so we'll pass it out now, and people have a chance to study it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate both your testimony. As Representative Springer said, no softball, so with all respect. And I'll ask this question to you, Lori, to start with. There's a lot of people who think that this bill, especially with the recent amendments, without putting any fine point on it or putting any, without softening it all, is a way to either kill or eviscerate the Oregon Connections Academy. Explain to us why that's not true. And if it is indeed not true, why do we need Section 13, specifically 13C, which seems to only highlight or sort of back into defining the Oregon Connections Academy, if that, in fact, is not the intent of what we're trying to do here?
Could you
or
point
what
out,
the bill is
can you tell us where that is?
Yeah, it's page 10, 13C, which, by my understanding, the Oregon Connections right. Academy would be the only school that would sort of qualify under this definition.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bruin, thank you so much for the question, because we've certainly heard a lot of misinformation ourselves in these 22 weeks, and I don't think it's over yet. Speaking from my association, no particular point of view about any particular provider as such. We do have concerns about certain kinds of quality issues, access issues, finance issues, and so on, and have made no secret, we've not been shy about that. To the extent that the Oregon Connection Academy is one of those providers, in fact, is the largest in the state, and has an intent to grow to 5,000, I believe was the last number I saw, and is at 2,700 now, with only 15 or fewer students coming from the sponsoring school district. It seemed to us that the structure that was created was one that, in effect, took school money that was intended, state school fund dollars that you all appropriated to the brick-and-mortar school districts, and rerouted those dollars, which were allocated based on projected enrollment by the superintendents of those school districts, to instead go to these programs. It doesn't. We don't subsidize all homeschoolers. We subsidize only a portion of those attending a particular school. It just seemed to us structurally as though that ought to be rethought, and that we ought to be purposeful in whatever the ultimate decision is of a legislative body about how online learning ought to be accessed, provided, and paid for in this state. It ought to be deliberate, not accidental. And to the extent that the authority, even of the state board, to grant waivers was an oversight, because the law in 2000 2005 addressed virtual learning, whereas the brick-and-mortar charter school law 6 years prior kind of was basically before this whole issue emerged as a question or a consideration. There were no virtual schools back then. There was this loophole created when you overlay the two. And so that is how ORCA, as well as other schools, got caught in the middle of that, because there are a number of private corporations. They call them on Wall Street education management organizations. And the education industry earns billions of dollars a year in this country accessing public resources for private gain. And to the extent that our association believes it's a legitimate question to ask whether that's the way we want to use our resources, I remember a few years back there was this movement to have the 65% solution so that more money could go to the classroom. Well, if money is not always going to the classroom, if it's going to other purposes, such as out-of-state shareholders, we just thought it was a legitimate public policy that you had a compelling interest in this issue to look at that. And it's not about closing anybody's school.
Mr. Chair, if I could just jump in.
Let me interrupt. We've been running on questions now for more than half an hour. I promised others that there would be an hour for their testimony. We are well into that time. Please keep answers very brief, and colleagues, keep questions to the point if you could, so that we have an opportunity to actually finish this hearing today. I have asked to find out whether we can move into session time for this committee. I don't know what the answer to that question is yet, but we're going to have to move right along. I've let it go a long time because I knew we wanted to get the questions about a complex bill answered so we understand what the bill says. But I'd also very much like to get to the witnesses who have come some distance, I think, to testify this morning. Please, Representative Brune, you had another question, and then Representative Springer.
Well, I think Representative Dembrough was going to comment.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say something that we didn't mention about the Attorney General opinion. It was issued after the ORCA, in seeking a renewal of its charter, threatened to sue the state because, you know, it said that the state did not have a right to limit its charter or to subject it to this provision. It threatened to either sue the state or go to the legislature and seek legislation to allow it to be exempted from that requirement. So, you know, I think that this needs to be viewed in the context of that threat.
Thank you. Representative Brune, did you have another one?
I'm fine, given time.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your indulgence. I'll be brief of one question only. We've talked a lot about quality and access, and that's probably the one thing the majority of us in this room, if not all of us, can agree on, that that's very important. And so, and I've heard the concern raised that this is an issue about quality and access, and perhaps that's being compromised. And I'm still looking for the examples of that compromised quality or that compromised access, because quite frankly, I see this bill as a threat to access in particular, and perhaps quality also. These are parents that have families that have chosen a different method to educate their kids, and that's okay. I've chosen the method that my husband and I have chosen the method we have, and we do that for various reasons, and nobody gets to question it because we get to make it. That said, show me, because I'll tell you what, if there's compromised access or compromised quality in the education that our online students are receiving, I'm all over that. I'm all over that.
George.
Yeah, thanks. Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, I would say, first of all, that we're not talking about an either-or situation here, right? I think that it is possible to seek a better model that would still provide access and a high degree of access and a high degree of quality. Also, I would say that there are other interests at stake here. One has to do with governance, and the other has to do with state finances and accountability. And I think that those are also at play here. And I think that we can come up with a plan, a system, that covers all of those for the better interest of Oregon.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a simple question. In one of the letters that I read preparing for this hearing, someone noted that the that this bill, if passed, would possibly preclude us from participating in the Race to the Top federal program. Is that true? Or, and if so, what is the source of our your response?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bantz, I also have a handout on that. I didn't want to swamp you with paper, but I do have it at the ready to give it to you. There was an organization that raised that as a possibility based on a personal email from one employee of 5,000 at the U.S. Department of Ed and based on some quotes taken from the new Education Secretary, Arne Duncan. We have also seen other information and have done a fair amount of research on this question. Race to the Top is a particular fund that will go to departments of education. Education only, not schools and students, in approximately 10 of the 50 states based on their work with student achievement and teacher quality issues, for example. I think Oregon is planning to apply for them on the basis of our agreements with the Mexican government, for example, to provide textbooks aligned to our content standards but written in Spanish, which is a help for student achievement for non-native English speakers, on the basis of our database initiative, our proficiency standards, and some other innovations that we have to offer in the state of Oregon. The word we got from our national sources was that if anything at all imperiled our ability to potentially compete for those funds, it would be our funding level, given our economic crisis, and not this bill. This bill does not permanently cap all charter schools. Arne Duncan spoke about the southern states that were enacting legislation to permanently cap all charter schools. We asked for a two-year timeout, and that's not a cap.
Thank you. Elsie is back.
Yes. Again, Hannah Lai, Legislative Council. I've had a chance to review the opinion from the AG, and I would say still based on statutes, I would have concerns about how the school could continue to operate after the passage of Senate Bill 767, but the Attorney General opinion really emphasized what the Department of Ed has adopted as their rules, which is that they will not enforce that 50% requirement against a school that had a charter that was enacted before the 50% requirement was passed. And the opinion goes into that quite a bit. Is the department reasonable in adopting such a rule? And the opinion includes that, yes, the department is. And I think that's a very reasonable conclusion. So I think it's more that the rule and the department's position that they will not enforce that 50% requirement until a charter school renews its charter is the very key factor here. So as long as that rule's in place and the department continues to take that position, then there is some security for that school until the charter has to be renewed.
Thank you. And one assumes that legislative intent also would be an issue if that if ever were challenged.
And I'd say you're developing a very good legislative intent right here, putting on record.
I would also refer you to Section D on page 8 of the AG's opinion, which in a very convoluted way says that the impairment clause, this contract clause of the federal constitution doesn't apply because the statute doesn't impair the contract. I think the implication is very clear that if it did attempt to impair the contract, that the contracts clause, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Federal Constitution would apply. Would you agree with that interpretation of this language?
I would agree with that, Chair. I think it would be very important to look at what the contract says and what sort of leeway they provide.
And how the statute's interpreted.
Correct.
If the statute's interpreted to leave the contract alone, then the impairment clause, the contracts clause, doesn't apply because there's no impairment. On the other hand, if the statute's interpreted as having an effect on the contract directly, then I think this language would indicate that the contracts clause does apply, even though it's written in a very convoluted way, a lawyerly way.
I would still be interested in seeing what that contract says.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. In the interest and an abundance of caution of building the legislative record and the legislative intent, before the end of the day, would it be possible to get the Department of Ed at the dais to talk about that rule and affirm their intent to maintain the rule that they have gotten and their intent not to displace students in September?
We can try. We can try. Thank you. Thank you very much. Maybe they're listening and maybe they'll come over.
I think
they're in the back.
Back.
Do you want to answer that question now? Are you able to? I'm going to excuse the two of you. We'll answer the question that was asked, and then I want to get, then I really want to get to my list.
Good Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Morgan Allen from the Department of Education, and I think Legislative Council laid it out pretty well. Our intention is not to apply the 50% rule to any virtual charter school until their contract comes up, and my understanding is that the Oregon Connections Academy is safe through the 2009-2010 school year, and they have currently asked for a waiver from the State Board of Education as their charter expires on, I believe, June 30th, 2010.
Thank you. Is that responsive?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification of the record, when you say our intention, could you define who our is?
Chair Barnhart, our would be the Superintendent of Public Instruction and staff at the Department of Education.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you for that. And the rulemaking authority is actually in the board, is it not? And then the board would direct the staff to take action. So are you speaking here today for the board or for staff?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, I think, you know, given my experience with the board, that the board actually, if I remember, very much was enthusiastic about getting that rule approved to make sure that it's that is clarified. So there's no intention. I did not believe the State Board of Education is planning on asking for a change of that rule.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from Jennifer Detman, Cindy McGraw, Gary Temple. And colleagues, we've taken just exactly an hour, including questions on this first group. We cannot possibly do that for the rest, and so I'd ask you to be as brief as you can while still getting the information in that you need to give us.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jennifer Detman. I'm the mother of three children who were students in the Oregon Virtual Academy through the 2008-2009 school year. I am currently, right now, in the process of trying to re-enroll them for this same program and have already been denied by the local school district the release that's required to allow this to happen. When my husband and I were originally exploring our options for our children's education, we were inclined to the philosophy of a virtual public education, as each of our children have extraordinarily different strengths and struggles when it comes to learning. I do not believe they would have been able to focus intensely on their strengths and cope with their learning struggles and be able to grow in the process if each of them had been in a different academic environment this past year. My husband works in property management. And that, combined with some recent setbacks in the economy, actually forced us to move twice in the past year. Although they were general moves into the same area, they would have required us to change our children's school district both times. Also, in addition to that, on a personal side, the flexibility of the virtual schooling allowed my children to spend some extra time with their great-grandmother, who passed away in November. And I can't imagine the impact of having to move them twice throughout the school year, as well as losing their grandmother, who's been there very close to them for a long time, would have had on them, and particularly their education, if they'd been enrolled in a brick-and-mortar school. I think they would have fallen behind. They would have had maybe more severe emotional impacts from those things happening. And I hope that our school district does allow our children to re-enroll, although they've already been denied. I will work on that still in the Oregon Virtual Academy for this upcoming year. And this, because the Oregon Virtual Academy is a public school that meets their needs and those of our family. Please make sure that this public school option continues to be available to my children and the thousands of other virtual public school students like them, and please vote no on SB 767. And I'm thankful for the time that you have given me to speak to you today. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much. I'd like to hear from the other two, and then we'll take questions. Please.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Cindy McGraw, and my daughter Lacey is 11. She's in the audience. She's currently enrolled in ORVA. She spent 2008-2009 attending ORVA and is re-enrolled for this next coming year. Lacey is currently a fifth grader going into sixth, but she'll be going into seventh. Lacey was diagnosed with a generalized learning disability and reading the summer between second and third grade. Lacey was tested at school, but she tested within the standard medium bell curve, and it was deemed that she was not eligible for additional help in the school, even though her teacher had come forward and told me that she felt Lacey had learning difficulties. At that time, Lacey was experiencing daily stomach aches and diarrhea. The summer between second and third grade, my husband and I had Lacey tested by a private practitioner, which resulted in her diagnosis. The psychologist indicated that Lacey had a very high IQ, but that her reading, especially comprehension, was abnormally low. As you know, reading comprehension, or lack thereof, affects all subjects, especially after fourth grade and up, when students are required to read for comprehension. During Lacey's fourth grade year, she was in a 4-5 blend class. Not only was she struggling, but now she was expected to adapt to 4-5 different teaching styles a day. This is the number of teachers she took classes from throughout any given day. As well, now Lacey had qualified for an IEP and was getting additional help in the school. Unfortunately, the IEP classes sometimes are unruly as there are often behavior issues associated with learning issues, and Lacey found this an even more difficult environment to learn in. As she continued to struggle through fourth grade, and upon finding out that her math teacher and her spelling teacher had no idea she was on an IEP and should be having some accommodations made for her learning, my husband and I decided to pull her out and place her in private school. When we did this, we also made a very difficult decision to hold her back a grade. So Lacey finished her fourth grade year at a private school amongst people she didn't know as a third grader. Lacey's private school fourth grade experience was not much better. The classroom size was smaller, and the opportunity for more one-on-one time to finish assignments was a plus. But her teacher quickly became frustrated with her and her repetitive questions due to her lack of understanding directions and her inability to read and comprehend directions. It was at this point that I realized that I would need to deal with her education one-on-one, at least until I could get her caught up. I looked at homeschooling programs, but was very overwhelmed knowing that I was not a teacher, and I had no clue how to draft a lesson plan or how to choose appropriate curriculum. I then found Oregon Virtual Academy. ORVA had a variety of learning venues, and since Lacey seemed to learn better through visual and hands-on approaches, we chose ORVA and moved forward with her schooling. I have been very satisfied this first year. Lacey, for the first time, feels like she is really making progress and does not feel the intense pressure to hurry and perform, regardless of her attention or understanding. For the first time, Lacey sits down to read a book because she enjoys reading. My concern for our daughter was that as she grew older, the pressure of life and continued schooling just mount. It is difficult enough for our youth to make good choices, and when you have a child with a weak character and lack of self-esteem from peers commenting on your F's and asking why you don't get it, or teachers that continue to push students forward even though they don't grasp the basic fundamentals to build on, you are eventually guaranteed some type of collapse, either academically, personally, or both. Recently, the Senate passed increase in taxes. Senator Vicky Walker, Democrat from Eugene, said it's about fairness. It's about trying to make sure that we provide for the most vulnerable in Oregon. Well, these kids you look at in these virtual programs are vulnerable. Some can't learn through traditional models, yet are very intelligent. Some aren't being challenged enough in traditional venues. Some just flat out fall through the cracks. The diversity in classes with regard to extremes of intellect continues to grow yearly. You have first graders who don't know the sounds that the letters make in the alphabet, and you have first graders that can read at a third and fourth grade level, and everything in between. We are simply trying to keep our kids from falling through the cracks. We are just wanting the best for them. Our responsibility as their parent is to provide them with a safe, nurturing environment to grow in, including education, in order to contribute to the society, healthy, sound, educated adults, our futures for tomorrow. Please consider keeping these programs alive and growing. I don't see a need to shut out thousands of students from a schooling opportunity that allows them to thrive and succeed, to feel good about their progress academically and thus who they are. Allow these programs to continue and do your studies of them and shaping of them as they continue to grow. ORVA offers a tremendous curriculum, hands-on opportunities for Lacey, guided by a certified teacher. She is tested annually with the same tests that her public school peers are tested with. Finally, I want you to know that the principal at our public school that Lacey used to attend supports Lacey in her efforts to catch up and supports me in my efforts to help my daughter succeed, as do her teachers from that school. I would like to leave you with this thought. Do you really know what it is like as a parent to struggle to get your child the educational help they need so that they can go to bed happy at night and not have to wake up in the morning filled with anxiety and feelings of inadequacy? So you as a parent don't have to spend 3-plus hours with your third grader struggling to get through homework that should take a half an hour. Please don't take this opportunity away from my daughter and the other youth that need this type of learning environment. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Temple. I am the superintendent of South School District and the sponsor of Oregon Connections Academy, one of nine online virtual charter schools in the state. My hope today is to start clearing up some of the misconceptions about ORCA. I will try to keep my comments short so you'll have the opportunity to ask me questions about what ORCA is and what it is not. First, ORCA and online education is not meant to be a K through 12 solution. It is not meant to be all 13 years of their education. Typically, it is used as a transition for a couple of years. We have had organ transplant patients, medically fragile patients. We have a student whose father is on chemo, and they've had to leave their house in Eastern Oregon and go to a Ronald McDonald house in order for him to get his chemotherapy. We have students trying to accelerate, pursue music or sports careers, students that did not fit into their regular school, students that require a one-on-one aid in their regular school system. One of the questions that continues to arise is the use of an out-of-state vendor and the contracting for services. Let's put this in perspective. All districts throughout the state contract for services. We contract with ESDs, teachers, administrators. We contract for computer services, and the list goes on and on. And to the question of out-of-state vendors, in actuality, we all use out-of-state vendors. The vendor that the state uses for state testing is from out-of-state. Laidlaw, one of the companies that provides bus transportation in the state, is located in Ohio. Dell Computers, the computers on your desktop, is from out-of-state. We buy textbooks from McGraw-Hill in New York, Prentice Hall in New Jersey. How about insurance providers? The state's largest student information system provider, serving more than half of the state's 550,000 students, is located in Ontario, Canada. As much as we would prefer to use only an Oregon vendor, there are no vendors in Oregon that offer a comprehensive, integrated K-12 curriculum that enables a full school experience. We keep hearing that all of the money goes out of state. All of ORCA's money is deposited in Sterling's Bank in Scio, Oregon. ORCA does contract for accounting services. And with all boards, they're allowed to contract for services as they see fit. As one of the procedural safeguards, the ORCA board has put into place with the vendor that they contract for accounting services, which happens to be Connections Academy, they are not allowed to write checks on the ORCA account. Instead, their vendor pays for everything up front for ORCA with their money, and then they are reimbursed at the end of the month. This gives the appearance that all the money is leaving the state, but in actuality is being spent at Oregon First. We hear that it's made up of homeschoolers. Currently, only 24% of the students that are in ORCA have come from homeschooling. As the normal progression of online education happens, in the beginning, homeschool students join first. And then as the program gets established, that number decreases. We hear that districts do not know who is in ORCA and that districts are not receiving any benefit. Every month, we send a list to each district of who is in the school with their contact information. And at the end of the year, we send a check to the sending districts for half of the money that is retained by SIO as part of our statutory requirement. One of the reasons that we send contact information to districts is in the hopes that they will reach out to these students and try to reincorporate them into their school system. I asked one of our local superintendents if that was, in fact, what they did. Her response was, these students are typically so disenfranchised with their home district that they will never come back. We hear that SIO profits from ORCA. If what you call what SIO retains for district operations profit, then ladies and gentlemen, I am here to tell you today that every district in this state profits off of their schools, because no district passes on 100% of the funding to their individual schools. Again, let me put this in perspective. In SIO, we pass on about 80% of our school funding to our individual schools. The other 20% is retained for district operations. This is not unlike organizations that charge an indirect for the process of handling and reporting the finances. Universities typically charge 20%. Community colleges around 12%. ODE charges just above 5%. Our holdback from ORCA works out to be 3.75%. But out of that 3.75%, we have to cover the costs of oversight, leaving only about 2% to support district operations. We have heard that the State Board has not acted. Over the past 2 years, the State Board has engaged in a thoughtful discussion of what online education is and what it is not. The process of understanding what online education is takes time. During that process, we have tried to serve as a resource to the State Board. And out of that process, they have started shaping the framework for online education in Oregon. The conditions that the State Board has proposed for granting a waiver to ORCA is a cap on enrollment, somewhere between what they had this May 1st of around 2,600 and 3,000 students. District permission for each and every new student that attends ORCA, and a waiver length of only 1 year, so that any new policies that the State Board came up with would be applicable to them. With this mechanism in place, do we really need to risk federal funds by placing a moratorium on charter schools? And I have a press release from the U.S. Department of Education that says that any cap on charter schools will severely hamper our ability to apply for Race to the Top funds. The moratorium will also close 3 charter schools at the end of next year should an agreeable solution not be passed in the next legislative session, the moratorium lifted and the solution implemented by the following fall, displacing over 3,000 students, because their waivers and their contracts end at the end of next year. The moratorium is not lifted in this bill until 2011. It makes sense to me to have a committee talk about what online education is in the state and for us to have those discussions. But I guess I would ask, let's let that committee have those discussions. Let's not take to them 7 of the 10 things that we want to have discussed and put it in legislation first and let them only talk about 3 of them. With that, I will close, and I will gladly sit here as long as you will allow me and answer questions.
And that's going to be a very short time, I'm afraid, because I still have 13, 14
Mr.
other
Chair,
people who would like to be heard, but we will entertain questions. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. I just want to talk to Lacey's mom just a minute.
Yes.
Because she made a comment that she took her daughter to this school because she didn't want to homeschool, and we heard Ms. Wimmer discussed this program as state-subsidized homeschooling. Would you describe it that way?
Absolutely not. I've been very impressed with the curriculum. I keep hearing this laptop learning. We do a tremendous amount of hands-on. Lacey has textbooks that we work out of just like she did in school. We do a lot of hands-on learning that are directed through the computer. That's where we do a lot of our reading, and I get a lot of our instruction, and I also do daily logging as far as attendance and performance progress. So in that respect, we do use the laptop a lot. But other than that, I think we have more hands-on learning than she had in public school. I would not consider it homeschooling at all. In fact, knowing if the moratorium goes into place, I'm already having anxiety about what am I going to do for the 2010-2011 year, because there's a possibility she may not be ready to integrate back into public school, and I am not going to put her there until I know she will be in a position where she can succeed. She's going into high school after that, and it would be a disaster if I did anything different. So I'm already having anxiety about that, and honestly, I'm feeling like my only other option, if this goes away, is homeschooling, and I don't know how I would do that. I am not capable and prepared to take that on.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Berger. Other questions for this panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, tell me the nature, if you would, please, if you receive them, and we all receive complaints of one nature or another. Tell me the nature of the complaints, if you receive any, regarding ORCA and the experience that parents are having or this access quality issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, we have not had a complaint over access to ORCA. And the nature of the complaints that I deal with, and I deal with them personally. So if I get a complaint, I open an investigation, I run the investigation myself to its fruition. Most of the issues that we've had to deal with special education and their sending districts and their desire or lack of desire to make sure that they get the needed specialized instruction.
Thank you. And in fairness, I realize that you're not the only one that would receive those, Jerry Wilkes. The principal would receive those also, but I certainly know that complaints quickly make their way to the top.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony. And I want to say, while the two of you are still sitting there, that as a parent, I know that it is critical for every parent to work very, very hard to get the best for their kids. I know there was a time when one of my children had a very unusual difficulty with vision, and we were extremely lucky to have stumbled upon a solution that worked. I sometimes wonder about what might have happened with that child if we had not found that solution. So I understand the anxieties that you're facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Karen. I'm not going to be able to read the last name. And Joni, it looks like Gillis. Whitney Grubbs.
Chair Barnhart, committee, for the record, my name is Joni Gillis. I'm an associate director at the Northwest Center for Educational Options, a nonprofit that supports high-quality public school options. I spent 30 years in education as a teacher and principal, was a startup principal of Howard Street Charter School here in Salem, Kaiser. In 1999, I went to the Department of Education as the educational specialist that was charged with implementing the new charter school law. In 2002, I became a director at the Department of Education, and my major responsibility was to oversee the Oregon charter school program. I then retired about a year ago, and I'm still interested in public school options in Oregon. I planned on providing information on the basic landscape of public charter schools in Oregon, but in the interest of time, I'll condense this and invite you to review the written testimony that we have provided. Basically, there are 88 charter schools in Oregon. 15,000 students are educated in the 88 charter schools. They're in 56 districts and 23 counties throughout the state, providing a wide variety of options within the public school system, many to at-risk and underserved students. I'd like to, although much of the testimony that you've heard today and throughout the last several months has seems to be directed at ORCA, I'd like to reiterate what Superintendent Gary Temple said, and there are nine virtual charter schools sponsored by nine districts that serve 4,500 students. And these students come from about 160 districts throughout the state. There's an Excel spreadsheet that you have been given, and this Excel spreadsheet will give you additional data on the number of students that attend each of the nine schools and what districts they come from. Basically, less than 1% of students in Oregon public school system attend online charter schools, and in most districts, less than 1% of the students attend these virtual schools. In the interest of brevity, I will close by encouraging you to read the written testimony and state that the Northwest Center for Educational Option believes online learning is a viable educational delivery model within the public school system and is here to stay and must be thoughtfully addressed, not just from the very limited lens of charter schools, but as an important component of the broader Oregon public school system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hikes, and I work with Joni at the Northwest Center for Educational Options. This is my first opportunity to testify before this committee, so I will tell you that I am a career educator who, for the last 5 years, has been leading the state's charter school organization and see charter schools as, see high-quality charter schools as viable options within the public school system. And as Joni mentioned, you know, 9 of the 88 charter schools in our state are virtual charter schools. This intersection between online schools and charter schools has happened because of some of the, you know, issues that you've heard about earlier today. So here we are, and here we are at this late hour in the legislative session, and I want to let you know that we have been working actively with legislators and with other education groups all session on this bill through 23 sets of amendments, and we have been trying to get to a consensus bill, and unfortunately, I need to share with you today that we still have concerns about this bill. Firstly, we are concerned that this, because we believe that this bill will close schools. The question is when. Will they close them this June? Perhaps not. Will they close them next June? Very probably. Very probably. Because there is a gap, as others have shared with you, between when the contracts and the waivers end and when the moratoriums end. And we are concerned about displacing students for reasons other than evidence of poor quality, and we have not seen that evidence. We are also concerned that the two-year moratorium on new virtual charter schools will likely render Oregon unable to compete for federal funds based on the press release and a lot of other information that we've seen publicly in articles and so forth from the Obama administration. And actually, a lot of the states that have charter school caps are in the process of lifting them so that they can compete for these funds. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be concerned about the moratorium because there's not a line of folks at the border waiting to start these schools. I'm only aware of one, and it's actually an Oregon-based organization. So if it weren't for possibly jeopardizing federal funds, we probably wouldn't mind the moratorium. In addition to the innovation funds, Oregon receives federal charter school program grant funds, about right now $4.75 million a year. And all of the charter schools that we have in our state have used these funds to establish their schools. If we limit, given the definition of a virtual charter school in this bill, if we limit those schools for a two-year period, we also could jeopardize those funds because our state may not be able to meet the commitments on which these grant funds are predicated. So we're also concerned about that because if we don't have those funds, we won't be starting any more charter schools in this state. So even though this is a virtual school bill, the implications for all of the brick-and-mortar charter schools are also here. Another implication is the composition of the task force and a bill that was active earlier this session that's now dead, Senate Bill 881, and the issues and the policy pieces in that bill, we are concerned that those would surface in the task force because the folks that requested the bill are primarily composing the task force. And one of those pieces was to underfund online charter school students even further than they already are underfunded. I don't know if you know, but charter school students in this state already receive about half of the public funds that students in traditional public schools receive. So we would be concerned about further underfunding those students. We don't see that we fund education in the state based on what we think it costs. If we were funding education in the state based on what we believe it costs, we'd be funding it at a much higher level. So this would be setting a precedent. You know, we all know that, quality education model. We're a long way off from that. So if we were to decide, you know, what we think it costs to educate students in an online environment and fund them at that level, that would be a new precedent for us. So we would be concerned about that and treating students differently based on the mode of education that they use. We are concerned about the task force composition. We believe that the folks who would mostly be impacted by the decisions made by this group are not represented. We also are concerned about the focus, which fixates and further cements charters and online. And I'm not sure that that's where we want to go. We've kind of gotten there by accident, it seems. And so to make a commitment that that's going to be the primary vehicle for continuing to deliver comprehensive online education before the task force meets also concerns us. We would support the amendments, I believe, that Representative Berger distributed. Those would address our concerns. I would like to make a comment about the political backdrop of charter schools in our state, if I might. In many states, the vocal active advocates for public charter schools are Democrats. They're Democratic legislators and others that are and span the political spectrum. In Oregon, the folks that drove the charter school law in the 1990s, and it took three legislative sessions to get that law through, they were primarily conservative Republicans. And we still have residue from that in this state, where the view seems to be that charter schools are a conservative issue. And we just want to emphasize that we really believe that charter schools are a bipartisan or even nonpartisan issue that appeal to both parties for different reasons. And we are concerned about the perpetuation of the stereotype that these charter schools, I mean, the folks that operate the charter schools, Joni and I know most of them, I would say they are predominantly moderate to liberal. We do not have a lot of ultra-conservative folks running charter schools in this state. And I just wanted to say that. It's kind of one of the elephants in the building, if you will. And I do have a press release in our handouts from Democrats for Education Reform, which is a group that is composed of Democratic legislators across the country that support education reform, including charter schools. And I learned from some of the legislators in your chamber that the Democratic Leadership Council also supports charter schools. And I just wanted to point that out while I had the opportunity. We would be happy to take questions on this bill. As I said, we've been involved all session on this, and we would like to see a resolution to these policy issues, but we feel like they're being a little bit muddied with some peripheral issues, if you will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning. Thanks for letting me be here today. My name is Whitney Grubbs, and I am a grant coordinator with the Clackamas Web Academy. The Clackamas Web Academy is a small virtual charter school sponsored by the North Clackamas School District. We serve 440 students in that district, and about half of those come from other districts. We are, our name has not come up a lot in these discussions, and in some ways we're thankful for that, but I really wanted to tell you a little about us so that you knew that there are other virtual schools out there and they are doing other things and good things. So I've handed out to you a couple of things. One is a press release talking about our state test scores for this year. Our principal at the beginning of the year said to himself and to all of us, I know we have a wonderful program, but if we want people to stand up and take notice, we have to do better on state testing. So this year, we increased participation by 28%. We increased our met and exceeded scores in math by 16% in 1 year. We increased our met or exceeded in reading by 5%. All of those scores now put us as having met AYP, adequate yearly progress for each of those categories. They're huge gains for 1 year. So how did we get to that point? Well, you know, it's nothing that you wouldn't understand. We talk to students, we talk to parents, we educate ourselves, we do research, we look at model schools, we brainstorm as a staff about how we can better serve students, and then we implement a model for the next year that is going to help us do better. So this bill seriously concerns me because it doesn't take into account the voices of those people who have been working so hard to figure out how to make virtual education work in our state. Our school, we have come to call our school a hybrid school in order to distinguish ourselves from some of the other virtual schools that are operating in this state, not because we don't think that they are doing a good job, but because we're different. If you look in Senate Bill 767 at the quality control section or the sort of, you know, quality best practices, those are modeled after our school. Our teachers meet personally with the students, every single student they have, every other week. We have PE. Our students take PE at 24-hour fitness, or they get a membership to 24-hour fitness. We enroll. We have many, many early college options for our high school students. All our students are required to do a senior internship in our community. All of our students are required to do 40 hours of volunteer service in the community. all of our students are able to come into our facility for classes, for tutoring, for ELL support. All of our students receive access to a computer. We have grappled with the issues of equity, access, and quality, and I believe we've come up with some really great ideas. But those ideas are evolving every year. This bill purports to stop it today, to say, oh, those are great ideas, and we're going to make them law today. Well, we think we're doing awesome, but next year we might be doing even better. But the law will state that these are the things that are required for quality. In addition, I'm so concerned. I'm an attorney. I practiced law for 6 years, complex commercial litigation. I can read a bill. I was pleased to hear that it's not the intent of the drafters of this bill to exclude people from the task force, such as operators of successful charter schools like mine. I think my principal, Mr. Bradlin, should be at the table. I think a parent of a virtual charter school student has to be at the table. I think there are experts in online education, and there's representatives from the Department of Ed. Those people have to be at the table. Now, it's nice of them to say that we will let them come and advise the task force, but if you read the bill without an amendment that says the official action of the task force will require a majority of the members, and those are the 13 members listed in the bill. So we can have people come and advise all they want, and the task force is completely slanted, and they can make a recommendation that has nothing to do with what the people that operate in this field have advised them. So I think there is just no way that you can vote yes on this bill without amending that makeup of that task force and have it appear that you're not trying to kill virtual learning in this state. In addition, the list of things, I'm sorry, this will be my last point, the list of things that the task force is tasked with considering reads like a list of foregone conclusions. If the task force is tasked with considering policy and making sure quality, equity, governance, funding, if those things are addressed, then that should be what the task force is addressed with looking at, not the issues that are listed in the bill that are basically just the concerns of this bill's sponsors. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. The last thing you said, appearances are not always reality, and although it may appear that a yes vote might look like we're trying to shut down virtual learning, I assure you that it won't be the case. And you can laugh all you want, but the answer is that I am at least very concerned with learning for all kids, and there are kids who learn better in different settings, and virtual schools is one of those settings. I want to continue virtual schools in this state, and I might very well vote yes on this bill, depending on how the how all the testimony and what it looks like. But I want to make sure that virtual learning is available in this state. And so I somewhat resent what you just said. And I don't want anyone to think that a vote of yes or no in this bill means that anyone on this committee is opposed to any kind of learning that helps the kids.
Mr. Chair, may I respond quickly?
Please.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. I would just ask you then to look seriously at the amendments and see whether or not those might make the bill a stronger bill in support of improving virtual learning.
Thank you. Others? Let me ask a couple of things. I am not familiar with some of the curriculum programs that we've been talking about. You mentioned a core curriculum called Odysseyware. Could you give us a very brief description of Odysseyware?
I can try, but I'm not really the best person for the job. I'm not a teacher, so I haven't worked with it hands-on. But we actually, in our program, we do use a paper curriculum for the lower grades. I think that's been talked about a little, whether or not it's appropriate to have young children online, and we've determined in our program that we want to try to not have them be online. So they use a paper curriculum, and then they move into the Odysseyware, which is an online delivery system. It has pretty much everything that you can think of projects. It has essays. It has lessons. It's an interactive curriculum. We schedule, at the higher levels, we schedule students for classes in the same way that a counseling department would schedule them in a traditional school. But again, like I said, the thing that's really different in our program is that we have our students are each assigned a teacher who does come and work with them and presumably their family or parent individually. I should mention, too, that the cost of that is a lot. And Karin mentioned if we are talking about funding for these schools in our program, you know, having individual a teacher individually drive to each and every student's home every other week, it's extremely expensive. We also offer a lot of courses in our facility, so we're not solely online.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in knowing if you think that there is a need for a task force and if there are issues that need to be addressed. It seems to me, as a member of, for 3 years, the Ontario HC School Board and 6 years on the St. Peter School Board, there's a huge question about funding and trying to maintain the brick-and-mortar system while at the same time trying to facilitate these new innovative methodologies. So my question to you is, do you think that a task force is necessary? Are there issues that need to be addressed?
You know, at the beginning of this process, I probably would have not thought of it, and so I wouldn't have answered yes. But I think now, I think we could be well served by a task force if that task force were adequately staffed, represented of people that have actually, had been working in this arena, and if it were tasked with addressing the right kind of issues. The way this bill is written, no, I don't think this task force is going to move us forward.
Thank you. Then the other question I had was if you would describe a little bit the qualifications of your teaching staff.
Absolutely. Our school is also different in that we are actually employees of the North Clackamas School District. You might may or may not know that in the world of charters, you can have an agreement with your sponsoring district. All the agreements are different. So our agreement with our district is that we are actually employees of the North Clackamas School District, and so therefore all of our teachers are already highly qualified, certified teachers.
So they follow the normal rules that, in terms of qualifications, that other teachers teaching in the regular public schools have to comply with.
Absolutely, and every teacher we have right now has moved to us from a traditional school, either in our district or others.
Thank you. Does that prompt any other questions? Thank you very much.
If I could just add to her answer, Representative Barnhart.
Yes.
All of the online charter schools, they don't all have the same employment model. Some of them are employed by the nonprofit charter school, but all of the teachers in all 9 online charter schools in the state are licensed by TSPC. You may know that in the charter school world, a minimum of half of the teaching and administrative FTE must be licensed in a charter school, but in the online schools, they're all licensed right now.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could briefly. I was a little late with my hand.
Yeah.
Thank you. In response to onlines, are there any exemptions to highly qualified status for teachers? I'm assuming not. NCLB, highly qualified status.
No.
So they are required to meet that same threshold.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. Liam, it looks like Malone, Mike Redway, Jerry Wilkes. And I apologize if I have messed up your names.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Liam Allen, and I'm an attorney representing Kaplan Virtual Education. Kaplan serves roughly 1 million students per year from elementary to postgraduate students. In Oregon, they have contracted with a local nonprofit charter board in the Reynolds School District to provide curriculum and technology services to the Kaplan Academy of Oregon. As you've heard today, there are many misperceptions regarding...
I'm sorry, you're ahead of my writing.
Okay.
Could you tell us again which school district...
Reynolds.
Is Reynolds, thank you. Please, go ahead.
There are many misperceptions regarding Senate Bill 767.
As you've heard, it's been amended 23 times, and the result, as I've reviewed it, is a poorly drafted bill with what I hope are unintended consequences. Within the bill, we have a task force that you've heard about the problems with the makeup already, so I won't repeat that, that creates a task force to study these issues and create solutions if there are any problems that are discovered. However, there are substantive requirements already contained in the bill that will be immediately effective. While virtual schools support quality standards, they need to be well-reasoned, and they're premature at this point before the task force findings. For example, in the bill currently, virtual charter schools will be required to provide complete lessons, including textbooks and other materials, in the native language of a student who is learning English as a second language. I'm pretty sure that is not a requirement in any brick-and-mortar charter school, and I don't understand the reasoning behind that. Additionally, my main concern is proponents of Senate Bill 767 have indicated that legislation will occur in a special session in February of 2010. We all know that can't be guaranteed, and with the current makeup of the task force, most of the virtual schools would probably have to oppose any legislation that comes out of the 2010 session. And in the meantime, while ORCA may not be closed by Section 13C right now, in June 2010, they would be forced to comply with the 50% rule, which would displace thousands of children. I don't understand the need for a moratorium until July of 2011 that would potentially close schools. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you very much, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee.
And if you'll back the microphone off just a little bit, it won't distort quite so much. Please, go ahead.
My name is Mike Radway. I work for the Knowledge Learning Corporation, which is the nation's largest private provider of education services in the United States. Every day we serve about 250,000 children across the country in at least 37 states. The bulk of our business is in early childhood education, but we also operate seven virtual charter schools in seven states across the country. Ironically, even though we are an Oregon-based and Oregon-headquartered company with approximately 1,000 employees here in Oregon, we do not operate in Oregon, largely because the current Oregon law without a waiver makes it practically impossible to operate a virtual charter school. But I'm here in part to tell you that the way this bill is currently drafted, it actually discriminates against two Oregon-based companies, my company and one other company, that would be interested in partnering with an Oregon school district to operate a virtual charter school here in Oregon, but would be precluded from doing so for at least 2 years and potentially longer, depending on what happens with the task force. And so we would ask you not to prevent us from partnering with local school districts to offer services that that school district and that parents and children across the state are interested in. We've heard a lot of talk today about for-profit institutions, and my company is a for-profit. But I think it's important to put this in perspective. If you look at the educational field, not only are virtually all vendors of services to school districts in Oregon for-profit entities, but my father was a teacher for four decades, and he got a salary every month. And in a sense, that made him a for-profit institution. And furthermore, all of the Oregon's law already requires that a virtual charter school be organized as a nonprofit. Now, that nonprofit can contract with other companies for goods and services, but the entity making the funding decisions with state funds is a nonprofit and has to have an arm's length relationship with any for-profit entity that it contracts with. So I think that the for-profit, not-for-profit issue is really a red herring in this issue. You've heard a lot about the 23 different versions of this legislation that have been proposed as it's worked its way through the legislative process. Unfortunately, the virtual school community has been largely left out of the discussions in those 23 sets of amendments, and from our perspective, the legislation has only gotten worse. And you heard one comment earlier today about how at one point there was even a slot on the task force for the parent of a virtual school child, and that disappeared in the process. That's, I think, one example of how this legislation has only gotten worse and why we've been foreclosed. And that's also why we're very deeply concerned about the makeup of the task force that's being presented, because we have largely been shut out of this process as it's moved through the legislature. That's why we think it's important that there be a fair and balanced task force, and it's amazing to me that you would even consider setting up a task force that didn't have the state regulator, the State Board of Education on, or multiple representatives of the and experts in online learning. When I look at our company, the head of our online learning division, in addition to operating our virtual charter schools, was previously the head of a state charter school association, and prior to that was the president of the second largest school district in the United States, the Los Angeles Unified School District. She has a wealth of experience, but as this legislation is currently drafted, you couldn't put her on that task force because there isn't a slot that she would fit into. That just doesn't make sense to me. Representative Bence asked a question about whether or not this jeopardized funding under the Race to the Top Fund, and I'm here to tell you that not only does it jeopardize funding under the Race to the Top Fund, but there's an additional $1.5 billion in Title I school improvement funds that would be jeopardized if you pass this legislation. And just to read two sentences from Secretary Duncan's press release issued week ago today, states that do not have public charter laws or put artificial caps on the growth of charter schools will jeopardize their applications under the Race to the Top Fund. President Obama has called upon states to encourage the expansion of charter schools. A network of innovative and high-achieving charter schools can be an important part of a state's school reform effort. This legislation places multiple restrictions and caps on virtual charter schools. In addition to the moratorium for 2 years, there's the existing state law requirement of the 50% cap, which, as best as I understand it, no other state has. In addition, the legislation, although it sets up a task force to study virtual education, contains at least 20, I sort of lost count as I was trying to catch them, at least 20 requirements that are going to be imposed into law on virtual charter schools, but not traditional schools, before the task force even begins to meet. So that's just another way in which we as a state are going to be made non-competitive for these funds. And then lastly, I would tell you that there is no immediate need for this legislation. There's no rush to pass what is, in effect, a poorly written piece of legegislation. You can, under current law, you can't form a new virtual charter school for all practical purposes without getting a waiver from the State Board of Education. That is going to remain in place regardless of whether or not you pass this bill. If you want to create a task force, the legislature can on its own create a task force. It doesn't need this legislation to create the task force, and if it doesn't have this legislation, it will actually have broader authority to create a fair and balanced task force than the one that is enumerated in this particular legislation. So I would urge you to take a deep breath, to realize that nothing dramatic is going to happen between now and next February, and set back and establish a task force, but do it without this legislation, and come up with a bill that is bipartisan nature, similar to the one that was recently enacted in the state of Washington, which passed unanimously in their state house, and I think by a vote of 37-9 in their state senate. It can be done, and I would urge us to do it.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Wilkes. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Connections Academy. And I've spent 40 years in the public school system as a superintendent, principal, or teacher. And other than the last 2 years, that time was in a traditional brick-and-mortar setting. But I can tell you that I have had to completely rethink how education can work now that I've been part of this incredible virtual school that serves over 3,000 students in Oregon in grades K through 12. Just as I did not understand virtual schooling when I first arrived at ORCA, there are many involved in this debate who are confused about us, and I need to debunk a few myths. First, some have said ORCA is just a way to get public money to homeschoolers. And I think Gary Temple mentioned this in his testimony. In actuality, the number of students who previously homeschooled before coming into ORCA is 23% of our enrollment. And even if it were higher, these are Oregon taxpayers who have elected to attend a public school. Anyone who spent any time at all in looking at our program would know in an instant that this is not homeschooling in any fashion. ORCA is a public school. Second, some have said ORCA is not transparent. In fact, ORCA submits monthly detailed financial statements, enrollment reports, operational reports, and meets every form of regulatory requirement that has been defined by legislation and the Department of Education. Our independent nonprofit board, its independent auditors, its district sponsor, and the third-party evaluator they engage in each year, since ORCA's inception, have reviewed our expenditures and our operations in detail. We are in full compliance with all regulatory requirements. The truth is the matter, in my experiences, we have been scrutinized more than any other public school, not only in Oregon, from other states and other schools that I've been associated with. Third, some wonder if we're accountable. All of our students take OAKE standardized tests under the same requirement as every other public school student in the state of Oregon. The 2009 results I'm going to give you are not yet public, but they're preliminary. We just got those on June 9th. But I can report that we will make AYP this year on all measures. And I want you to listen to these scores. For reading, third grade, 87%. Fourth, fifth, and sixth, and seventh grade, all 89%. Seventh grade, 86%, and eighth grade, 83%. To put these scores in perspective, every grade would exceed, and in some cases in a large measure, the statewide scores for last year. Many of our students come to us well behind in math after years in the public system. Yet, even in math, we continue to improve each year, and we expect these results will exceed the state. Third grade, 77. Fourth grade, 78. Fifth grade, 80%. Sixth grade, 79%. Eighth grade, 76%. In grade 10, where our students have been the longest in the public school system, we continue to struggle, but our reading score of 75% will likely exceed state again this year. And our math score of just under 50% will be close to last year's state score. And for us, representing 25%, let me repeat that, 25% improvement from the prior year. Every year our academic results continue to get better, even though 50% of our students on the same measure that is used by every other public school are low income and would qualify for free and reduced lunch.
Would you repeat that percentage?
You bet. Be happy to. Every year our academic results keep getting better, even though 50% of our students are on the same measure that used by every other public school on free and reduced lunch. That's why I urgently need to speak with you about Senate Bill 767. Section 13C of Senate Bill 767 has passed by the Senate, says that it applies to all public charter schools operating in the state immediately unless they comply with the 50% requirement or were granted a waiver. Neither of which we can do because the number of students we have enrolled in the state board's failure to grant us a waiver before the date that passed months ago, that is specific bill. I want to be real clear here and about what the issue is here today. Doing what's right, and I've been in this a long time, and my passion is children. And doing what's right for several thousand of Oregon's own public school students. Every child at ORCA is a public school student. Attending a school, they have chosen to meet specific learning needs that produces good academic results for them. I have come here this morning to speak for those children. The children who have food allergies and cannot, for medical reasons, attend a traditional public school. For children who have life-threatening diseases and are confined to a hospital bed and cannot attend a traditional public school. I'm here to speak for the children who have been bullied in their neighborhood schools and are afraid to go back. I speak for the children in rural Oregon who, because of long distances, cannot attend a traditional public school without spending hours on a bus. I am truly shocked at the total lack of compassion that proponents of Senate Bill 767 shows for these thousands of hard-pressed Oregon families, your neighbors, your constituents, who just want the best public school for their kids. Who will speak for the Oregon children? I am here to speak for them, because I feel that all the politics, rules, debates, and special interests that have been demonstrated throughout this legislative session with Senate Bill 767, you have forgotten about the children we serve, their outstanding academic achievements, and why their parents feel so strongly about freedom of choice in the state of Oregon. Next Saturday, and this is my closing remark, next Saturday, June 20th, just down the street at the Salem Conference Center, we will graduate 50 seniors, our first graduating class from ORCA, the class of 2009. This will be a joyous and exciting day for students, parents, and staff in our school. Many of them have been accepted in some of the most prestigious colleges and universities around the country because these institutions respect our accredited, highly quality program. As a lifelong public school teacher and administrator, I ask you to show me and my 72 hardworking teachers, and most importantly, the parents and teachers of ORCA, that you do believe that they come first. Thanks for this opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, in the middle, your name, I forgot.
Mike Radway.
Mike, thank you, Mike. And please, the Chair has been very patient with me today, so keep your answer as brief as possible. As we look at, and I'm going back to this language on page 6 of the bill, lines 14 through 26, surely you're familiar with that. I sat on a school board for 5 years. It was very important to me to know where the money was going, and if it wasn't important to me, and it was, I had people reminding me that it better be important to me. And so I understand that piece, and I sincerely appreciate the transparency piece and co-sponsored legislation for that. However, this looks different than what school boards typically are held to, and quite frankly, my interest, I'm just going to be very honest with you, my interest isn't as much you and your business as it is the ability for our onlines to have access to solid curriculum to serve the students. How does this language, very briefly, work for you or not work for you? Or am I reading something that isn't there?
No, I think you're probably correctly interpreting it. We would ask, as a business, to be treated basically the same as every other business that the state or any of its subdivisions deals with, and to be treated neither more favorably nor more unfavorably. There are no similar requirements that I know of on any other entity that offers goods and services. You can look, for example, at the hospital field, the medical field, where there are both for-profit and non-profit entities. There are no similar requirements there. Obviously, particularly when one is dealing with curriculum, there are tremendous desires to make sure that proprietary information can remain proprietary when it comes to curriculum. But those would be our concerns.
Thank you. And that second question, very briefly. Jerry, just a quick question, so hopefully a quick answer. Do you believe, honestly, do you believe that Senate Bill 767 as it is today is going to close ORCA, and at what point? And any of the other onlines? We've just focused there, and we're doing other schools and other students.
Yes, I believe it would after 2009-10 school year.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I want to declare a potential conflict of interest. My sister is a retired school teacher and works for the same company that Mr. Radway represents.
Ah, thank you. Your conflict is noted. Other questions? In the last few days, there have been a number of full-page newspaper ads in major newspapers in Oregon, I think primarily in the Portland area. And at least in one House district, a number of mailings that appear to be general mailings have been sent out urging the member of the House to vote in a certain way on this bill. Somebody is spending a great deal of money to try to influence the outcome of this bill out in the public. Do any of you know who might be spending that money? I'm certainly hoping it's not the nonprofit charter schools themselves, but I suspect that it's somebody who is making money from the operation of the companies that contract with online charter schools. Do any of you know anything about that? And if so, could you tell us about it?
I do not.
only that I believe that the ad was signed at the bottom, so I assume that that tells you who the sponsor was, and I remember seeing the ad, but I couldn't tell you the name of the group.
Thank you. I appreciate that answer. Anything else for this panel? Thank you. Jessica Cozzano, Christina Ribali, Anne Marie Gurney. And I may have butchered those names, too, and if so, I apologize. Colleagues, we could be called to the floor at any time, and it's my intention, if we are, to continue the hearing at 1 o'clock. Please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jessica Cuzno. I'm a parent of a child in Scioto School District's ORCA, as well as two children in Tiger-Tualatin School District. I had indicated on the sign-in sheet that I have written testimony and did bring it, but listening to the questions up here, I've significantly changed my testimony, so I'd ask your indulgence in letting me submit that later on today. My husband and I are both well-educated graduates of the public school system with both undergraduate and graduate degrees from public universities. Despite the fact that my family could afford to send me to private schools, I graduated from a public high school and continued on academic scholarship through public college and law school. It is this interest and belief in public education that I came to looking at my own children's education with. When my oldest son started kindergarten, we were excited to put him on the bus and send him to the big kids' school to learn. Again, despite a financial situation that would have allowed us to send him to private school, we chose public education. That first year was an eye-opener for us. I remember talking with his teacher, who asked if I thought he was learning a lot in class. My response was that the hour he spent with me at home was far more educational for him than the time he spent at school. Despite this initial setback, we found that the elementary school was wonderfully accommodating to him, both before and after he qualified for the TAG, or Talented and Gifted designation. And we were excited to see that the public schooling model was still at work. With this background, imagine my surprise when he entered middle school, and I was told that not only were there no gifted classes available to him, they were unwilling to adjust the work level to match his tested abilities. In fact, they told me more than once that I would have to resort to getting an independent education plan, or IEP, for him if I wanted to ensure that he was getting higher level work than his age-based classmates. It saddened me to see that the TAG designation and regulations were not enough to motivate them to educate their brightest students. At that point, I began looking at different options. I investigated the local private schools and even looked briefly at homeschooling options. However, I still wanted to believe that public education would be able to meet his abilities. As a public school, chartered through Scioto School District, I have found that ORCA is the best of both worlds. I am able to ensure that my son's education is not being sacrificed, and he is still getting the important public school education that I treasure. Virtual schooling has allowed for his level of individualized education, or for a level of individualized education that I could never hope to enjoy at our local middle school. Instead of spending his time bored, waiting for the other students to understand or the teachers to assign more work, he is challenged to complete as many assignments in a day as possible, or to spend the excess time in his day volunteering within the community. In addition, the assignments themselves are in many cases far more rigorous than he was receiving at his old middle school. At this point, I would like to take a moment and point out that I take umbrage to this description of my child's education as homeschooling. He is not homeschooled. He has somebody else besides me setting up his curriculum, meeting with him on, at minimum, a weekly and frequently a daily basis to discuss his assignments and the individual work that he is doing. I act as a proctor, little else. ORCA's future, as well as that of the other virtual schools, now hangs in limbo. Senate Bill 767 would hold these schools hostage to a system of waiting and regulations that would cripple them beyond repair. The provisions and task force called for within Senate Bill 767 create a moratorium on the growth of these schools, as well as the issuance of waivers allowing it to operate at its current level. Although there is disagreement as to whether ORCA should be subject to the waiver provisions within ORS 338-135, the school has applied for one with the Department of Education. The department has since stated that they are interested in waiting to see the outcome of virtual charter schools at the legislative level prior to approving any waivers. Unfortunately, if these waivers are not granted, virtual charter schools may well disappear at the end of the coming year, the 2010-2011 school year. as an option for our students, making moot the completion of the task force work. Indeed, whatever the intent of a legislator voting yes for the bill, the de facto result may be to close these schools. Additionally, there are no virtual charter school parent or charter school representatives listed in the task force makeup. While I agree with the need for the study of virtual schooling, it is unseemly that those stakeholders who are most affected by the decisions of the task force are left entirely out of its decision-making process. The lack of a balanced group means that they will be no better informed about the issues than we are now. Indeed, I understand that the sponsors are willing to add other parties to the table. As a practicing attorney, I have learned that the value of promises being put in writing is immeasurable. I have had to spend innumerable hours trying to untangle contracts where intent was not clear, and I would hesitate to put that restriction on a task force. I understand that our problems, or my personal problems, with the local public school district are not the same as everyone's. In fact, my oldest child's issues have not been the same as my younger children's, and they currently remain in the local public elementary school, where I am also president of the PSO and a member of the $1.3 million Bridging the Gap Foundation fundraising effort. So I support the local public schools just as much as I support ORCA. It is that point that causes me to feel so passionately about this situation. Not all children are the same, and with those differences comes different learning styles and needs. As noted in ORS 338.15, these differences are something that we should not only celebrate, but encourage and foster as innovation becomes more important with the education system. And the more children we can continue to competently educate through high school and above, beyond in any way necessary is something to strive for. It is with this in mind that I urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 767. Today and other days, I have heard concern about small districts essentially poaching students from the other school districts around the state. It is my understanding that there are 149 of the 199 districts represented in ORCA. However, one-third of these have less than 5 students going to ORCA, and 75% of those have less than 20 students going to ORCA. Students often have no other alternative, and in my personal case, there is no other alternative. As much as I would love to keep my oldest son in Tigard-Tualatin School District, there is no comparable program. And although they are working towards a partial online curriculum, it is nothing as extensive or as able to accommodate his needs as what we've been offered with SIA's ORCA. Thank you for your time. I'll leave you later with my letter, as well as a letter that my 11-year-old son wrote to the Senate committee when it was being debated there. I'd be happy to answer questions with you and offer any other input you'd like.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, is Christina Ribali.
And it will distort less if you lean back just a little bit. Thank you.
I'm always the tallest one, so I have to move the microphone. I will tell you, I have a dog in the fight in two things here. My daughter is currently enrolled in a public school in the McMinnville School District. My son is currently enrolled in Oregon Connections Academy. Children are different. The audacity for a group of people that do not have their children enrolled in the public school to tell me the best way that my child learns is very upsetting to me. We as parents do our level best to provide for the best education for our children. And excuse me if this is personal, but this is personal. We are not disconnected parents. We are not looking for you to solve our problems. We have seen the problems with the public education, and we have found solutions. This program is a solution for our children. My daughter, who is in kindergarten, is currently reading at a second and third grade level. Not because her teacher taught her, because I taught her. I am using programs at home to supplement my children's public education. This program, these online charter schools, give us, the parents, the opportunity to teach how our students learn. My son, in his public education experience, has been bullied,
He has been beaten up. He has been called names. And the response from the students or from the school has been, "We're sorry, Mrs. Rabali. We can't possibly help every student." So from this mother, I am telling you, we have withdrawn my son from public school and left my daughter in public school because they have different needs. My son is a highly intelligent student who is falling behind because he's bored. 25% of the children in his class do not speak English in fifth grade, which means 25% of the time that my son's teacher spends is teaching children to speak English in fifth grade, and my highly intelligent student spends the entire day writing in his journal, reading other things, doodling. Why? He's bored. His teacher asked me not to mention her name, but she told me, "You are doing the right thing for your son to pull him out of this school. And I'm not supposed to tell you that because I'm a union teacher." And this gets very personal with me because if it was honestly about the students, there wouldn't be union backing, putting millions of dollars into this bill. If it was really about the students, you would be asking the parents. There would be committee members on this panel saying what is right for our kids. If this was really about the comments that I've heard about equity and access, are you kidding me? 50% of the students in this school are below federal guidelines. What other equity of access do they have? Are their parents going to put them on a charter in a bus somewhere else? Are they going to take them to a private school? I don't think so. If they are really below, 50% of the children are below poverty levels, most likely both parents are working, which means they can't homeschool children. They're at the mercy of your decision. If this was honestly about the students, this wouldn't even be an issue. You would look at the results. You would look at what these schools do for families, and you would say, this is a good choice. One of the other complaints I heard is the notion of this money coming out of districts and going to a different district. I'm incensed at the idea that we're going to start looking at the money issue and following the trails. When I pay my taxes, my money goes all over the state, and I don't hear anybody talking about that. My money leaves my district every single day for things that I don't approve of. And this parent, who I'm a business owner, I employ 10 people, I work from home, I am there every day with my children, making sure that they have the right to an education. And this gets very personal for me. You can sit, every committee can sit up there and make laws and make rules, but when you take away choice and competition, you doom children. You doom them to an education of mediocrity. And if we are ever going to seriously consider what is the best option for our children, it is going to be choice. It is going to be parents having a say. I will continue to keep my daughter in the local public school as long as it serves her needs. And I am praying and I am hoping that you will make the right decision to allow other children that don't learn the same way to have the choice to go outside of that. Because my son is brilliant. My son has not been given the opportunity in his classroom because it's different. And if you truly want what is best for children, you will vote no on Senate Bill 767, and you will get rid of this idea that every kid has to fit into the same model. Because this parent says that's not the way it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Barnard and the committee, my name is Anne Marie Gurney, and I reside in Portland, Oregon, in the Portland Public School District. Representative Dembro, who is the first to speak today, is my representative, and I have had a lot of personal contact with him over this bill, and he and I both know we disagree. Let me tell you my history. My kids are here today. They're the two cute ones in red in the front row that I'm really trying to keep them quiet, so bear with me.
They're doing fine.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you. And how we came to choose Oregon Connections Academy, we just finished second grade. Our oldest son was in private school, and by the end of first grade, I'm going to keep this really short, had no first grade math skills. And we were at a crossroads. I knew that if he went to a public school, and I'll tell you why we came, what we looked at with our public school, he would come out of second grade with probably the same level. We have a neighbor who lives down the street from us. She is 1 year younger than my oldest, and I asked, after we had started Oregon Connections Academy this year, how's your school experience going? And she is in first grade. At the very beginning of the school year, her first grade class was merged with a kindergarten class with a class size of 35 students and one teacher and no assistants. And I just hurt physically for that poor teacher trying to teach kindergartners who should be starting to read at reading level and first graders who have started reading and trying to keep that going. And I asked, what's her daily experience like? What's it like? And her father told me very specifically, so a lot of time she's sitting with a worksheet by herself without guidance, without instruction, without another task to do. And I can tell, as good as my kids are doing right now, that is not the norm for them. They couldn't handle that, especially my older. To whatever we need to do something next. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that waste of time and the work ethic that it creates in children of just having to sit there and wait. And I didn't like that. So we continued with the Oregon Connections Academy. My son has just finished. He is at a 94% level with a 92% in second grade math. So he just made up 2 years of math in 1 year. Thank you to Oregon Connections Academy and his wonderful teacher who worked with me very much on how to get him to that point. And he's now going to start third grade on level, which I'm very proud of, and he should be too. Speaking to Michael Dembro, we've talked a little. I've heard a few people mention the conflicts of interest. Personally, when I talked to Mr. Dembro, I think he might have a conflict of interest. His employment outside of being a state representative is he works for a union. His employer is a union, is a teacher's union. And here he is sponsoring this bill for his employer. And I have real issues with him, and I've told him this personally, that he is not representing me. He's not representing his district. He's representing his employer. And I have a problem with that, unfortunately. And I don't know what else I can do about that. He and I also disagree very much on, I've told him the schools that are available to me in his district, and he thinks they're fine. I don't think they're fine. I don't want my kid in a 35-person classroom with one teacher and no teacher's assistant. The high school that's available to us is a red-listed high school. That's not good enough for me. I have one chance to educate my kid, and after that, it's a life sentence. If my kid goes through life with only a mediocre, red-listed sort of high school experience, it is now a life sentence. He will have a hard time finding a job. He will have a hard time getting into college. And I want my kid, when he graduates from high school, to be able to go get a job and compete in that workplace or to go to college and be able to pass academic snuff. And I don't feel like I have that available to me. So even though I may not be one of those families that lives out in the rural districts, or we don't have the food allergies, we don't have the physical limitations, I feel like I do, because my choice in public education in the biggest city in this state doesn't offer me much at all. So when we found Oregon Connections Academy, I'm going to echo another parent, we looked at Oregon Connections Academy, looked at homeschooling, and I just about cried when I realized what responsibilities would be on me as a homeschooling person, and we couldn't do it. But when we found Oregon Connections Academy, I'm like, I can do that, because I want a teacher to drive this boat. You don't want me to drive this boat, because it's not going to work. So it has been a great experience, and again, I really do want to go back to what Christina has brought up, and I really don't think this is about education. And when you boil it down, I think it's about union sponsoring a bill. Really easy to see. If you look at the top of the bill, there's the representatives and several unions and lobbyist groups listed after that. If those people hadn't pushed this legislation here, we wouldn't be here today. We would be embracing charter schools. We would be embracing innovative learning. We would be looking as a new way to educate kids, not a new way to replace old ways, because the classroom setting definitely does work for many, many students. This is just another option, and it provides choice to parents. And thank you very much.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the Chair will indulge a somewhat tangential comment, I wanted to thank you and all the parents here who have brought their children today. I think it's a wonderful experience for these kids to be able to see how their government operates for them and to engage in a civics lesson for today. I think it's very useful. And I would say to them and to everybody else who is learning about the legislative process, we are a citizen legislature, and we do have often outside responsibilities and duties. I would say that responsibilities and duties often inform our views and what we do here, but that every legislator, whether Republican or Democrat, is very able to separate for their legislative duties from their other duties. And I would say that every piece of legislation that comes forward sponsored by a member of this body is one that comes from the intention of advancing the best public policy.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. I've been given the high sign that we need to go to the floor. I'm going to take one question from Representative Springer. Then we're going to recess until 1 o'clock. We will need to find another place to meet since there's another committee meeting in this room, but we will post the location so others will be able to find us. Representative Springer, you had a question?
That's a very brief comment, Mr. Chair. Thank
yes.
you so much. Mom, those kids have sat for 2.5 hours.
They've done very well. Yeah. That's right.
They deserve ice cream on the way home.
I'm sorry, what was that?
They deserve ice cream.
Oh, McDonald's.
Thank you very much. And with that, the committee is recessed until 1 o'clock.